This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Hi, this is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. Welcome to my new abode. Things have changed around here. The only thing that hasn't changed is the picture of Annie on the back wall behind me, and now the original painting from the communion cover is beside her, and a beautiful crop circle painting, photograph sent to me a long time ago by a dear friend and former webmaster, James Beeson. And my books are on the other side, a lot of my books, and it's a warmer, nicer environment in which I am very pleased to bring today someone you know well and who is one of our most popular guests for a reason. He is one of the best researchers and diggers out there. I'd like to welcome Preston Dennett to the show. Hello, Preston. Welcome. And I'm so glad to have you back for the 116th time, at least. I'm looking forward to a great morning. The new book is, I got a bunch of questions all written out for you. So let's get started. How are things going? And it's just in general in your world.
Oh, not bad. Keeping real busy, having fun still, continually surprised with this whole subject of UFOs and all that comes with it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, always working on another book. Dolly says hi, by the way, working on Symmetry Number 2 about her experiences. So, yeah.
Oh, great.
Busy.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I think that I'm, in my case, I'm working on my new book, and I hope to have it out by Christmas. I hope to have it out by April. Then I hope to have it out by October. Now Christmas. Now, this new book in the Not From Here series, I believe it's the fourth or fifth book in the series.
Number five.
Yeah. But there's something very special about it. In the past, all of the books have been basically taking a more magnified look at certain UFO events or situations. This is all new material. And there's so much old material still out there. Why did you choose to go in the direction of new?
Because I still had some things I wanted to explore. You know, this Not From Here volume was basically drawn from the many articles I've written over 35 years of research now. And, you know, some of those articles were excerpts from various books, and I didn't want to use those because you can get them in my various books. But a bunch of them were published only in magazines, which have a very short shelf life and really weren't accessible to people. So that was kind of my goal, is to make, because a good portion of my research was just not available. And I basically got most of it out except for a couple of articles. And I thought, you know what, I still have some other ideas here. So let's just make this last volume, volume five, which is probably going to be the last one for at least some time, and complete this mission that I have. And I've had so much fun with these volumes because I get to explore sort of avenues of research and patterns of cases that are a little bit controversial, perhaps a little bit of outliers, haven't been explored before, not in any depth perhaps. So yeah, I've had a lot of fun with it, but this is probably going to be the last for a while. And this one, yeah, has got some new stuff in it that I've never really looked into before and certainly surprised me. You think you know something, and then along comes a new case and it sends you down an avenue of research you never expected to go down.
That is so true, boy, for all of us. I have to say, there's a little bit of an autumn leaves quality in what you just said. Are you planning to pull out, or am I misreading?
No, just, you know, there are times it's a little overwhelming. I'm done. I can't take, you know, because you kind of live, breathe, and eat, and it's a 24-hour thing with this subject. But no, I'm not pulling out. I'm in for the long haul. I've got three or four more books I'm already working on. A couple of, like, Symmetry 2, another UFO book. I'm going to do one on out-of-body experiences, because I did one on that and still have more. A little branch out more to paranormal a bit, but no, I'm in for the long haul.
Yeah, you know a lot about out-of-body experiences, as I recall, and you're able to have them. I've had a few very powerful ones, but very, very few, and I'm only responsible for initiating one of them, and I don't think I really initiated it. Tell us a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, I became interested in out-of-body experiences following the death of my mother. I was young, 19. She was young too, 49. So as you can imagine, this was very unexpected and tragic. And I was a skeptic at the time of all things paranormal, life after death, UFOs, ghosts, you name it. And even, you know, a couple of weeks later after she passed at the service, I did see her spirit driving up in the car, sitting next to my father. It was her sitting in the front seat. And of course, I didn't think ghost or spirit. I thought, well, I'm hallucinating with grief. And thought, this is going to be my deep, dark secret. I'm not telling anyone. Because there are people on either side of me and no one's reacting. I'm like, well, you know, this must be a hallucination. Don't think it was in hindsight. I think I did see her spirit, because it wasn't long after that she started visiting me in my room, in my dreams, lucid dreams. It was very strange because it happened over and over again where she'd walk in and I'd wake up. I was sure I was awake. She would basically try to tell me that she's okay, not to grieve, everything's going to be fine. And then I would wake up for real. So these were like false awakenings, which turns out to be a signal of lucid dreaming. That's what got me interested in this subject, in dreams, which led to picking up Robert Munro's book, Out of Body Journeys, which was very compelling, very believable, a little scary, but he gave exercises on how to do it. And I thought, well, let's give it a try. This is a way you can actually experience this yourself. And it worked. You know, little exercises on meditation and relaxation and visualizations. Took me about a month and a half before I had my first OBE. I knew right then and there, there was life after death. That he was telling the truth, and had one the next weekend after that, because I'm very busy at this time. I'm going through college. I'm working pretty much full time. I didn't have a whole lot of free time and was only doing this on weekends, but I never looked back. I mean, I doubled down on the meditations and started having them regularly. I'm still having them to this day.
Wow. That's all I can say. You know, you mentioned that no one else saw her in the car. That takes me to something that Anne said right after she died. It looks like everyone is intentionally ignoring us, which is, you know, except you, and in my case, me. And I wonder how many people... Oh, you know, before we go on, let's take the opportunity between questions to take a little break. We'll be right back. We're talking to Preston Dennett. We're talking about his new book in the Not From Here series. We're getting to it. We've segued into OBEs. We'll segue back soon. There's a lot to talk about today. Certain people can kind of see, and you're certainly one of them. Why do you think that is?
You know, I honestly can't say for sure. I'm 5 of 6 kids. There was a lot of us. And here I am kind of going off the deep end with all this. And everyone's looking at me like I'm a little bit, you know, crazy, honestly. I'm like, haven't any of you had any experiences like this? And it turned out that privately they told me they did. Not necessarily seeing a spirit directly, but certainly dreams or feelings of a presence. I think people have a tendency to ignore what's out of their worldview, what kind of challenges their belief system. I've always been kind of a sensitive guy. I did have a couple of profound psychic instances as a young child. So maybe there's something to that. But I was always kind of a meditative, philosophical guy. Maybe that's a factor here. I don't know. Hard to say for sure. But I suspect everyone has these kinds of experiences. But I have a tendency to sort of brush them off or explain them away.
Yeah, exactly. That's what we do. We explain these things away, and we shouldn't do it, because there's something about life that there's more here. And if we keep brushing it away, eventually it ignores us. If you keep going for it, it responds. That's my experience anyway. So now you've also written this. Well, you know, instead of, we're going to talk about more about in depth about OBEs and human levitation and preview Preston's new book in a little while. I wanted to go into Not From Here. Now, this is a book that, first of all, the series folks is, if you're not into it, it's, if you want to learn something about UFOs and about the history of this whole thing, that's where to go. The whole series is just top drawer. It's excellent. Now, you start out in the book with, I believe, with UFO swarms, if I'm not correct. Yes. Okay. Why did you choose that? And tell us a little bit about what that is, even.
Yeah, I would call UFO swarm basically a super fleet. It's not unusual for when people see a UFO. Actually, it's more common than not to see multiple objects. I've interviewed a lot of people, and people report a UFO sighting. There's usually one or two or three in the sky. But it's not unusual for people to report more than that, five or even 10 or 20. But above that, no, that's very unusual. And yet I did have a case pretty early on in my research. A wave of sightings occurred over Topanga Canyon. This was starting on June 14th. 1992. Topanga is a community right outside of Los Angeles in Southern California. And a bunch of people were calling the police on that evening, the local newspaper. This is where I grew up, so I knew the area well. I knew a lot of people. I just moved out to a neighboring town. But it turned out on that one night alone, some 30, 40 different groups of witnesses in various locations were seeing UFOs. Some saw one or two objects. A few were chased down the highway. Some had them landing next to their homes or hovering over their houses. One guy he was driving through the canyon, and he saw a very large craft emitting about 20 smaller craft. He had two friends with him as well. They watched it for 20 or 30 minutes before driving on. But I did talk to one couple who don't want their names used. I called them Daniel and Catherine. They live very high in elevation in an area which overlooks the Pacific Ocean and LA and pretty much a 360 degree view. And early that evening, June 14th, they saw a group of 10 or 20 objects come up from behind the ridge, dart off in various directions. And 5 or 10 minutes later, they saw another group. And when this happened a third time, 10 or more objects came up from behind this ridge. They started counting them. It started at 8 o'clock and it went till about 10:30, when they actually closed the curtains, shut the doors, and refused to look outside anymore, because this was so upsetting. They counted more than 200 objects. And that, yeah, that's insane.
I wonder what these were, because, you know, I have some friends, some dear friends, who have a house by a lake in upstate New York. And one night, I recall it as being like an hour, glowing orbs came up out of the lake and went into the sky one after another, or maybe went down into the lake. But in any case, what do you make of something like that, Preston? What does it mean? Or does it have any meaning that we can discern?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know for sure. You're asking me to speculate, which is fun, but I try to avoid it. I'm guessing this was either, you know, some major operation where they're going out and contacting people. Because these were craft. These were fairly large. One came right over their head, and they saw it was kind of a half-disc shape, made a low buzzing noise, your classic
kind of... these were not light. They were physical things.
Right.
Absolutely. Yeah, the ones that saw... I think that when we see these things at night, we're actually often seeing physical craft, but they, you know, we only see what parts of them glow.
Yeah, I think they've got, you know, a lot of plasma perhaps surrounding the craft.
Yes.
Because I've got a lot of cases of that where people see a star-like light and it comes down, 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 and boom, it's metallic.
Yeah, when you say plasma, I'm going to digress here a little bit, but that's how we work together and we talk together. When you say plasma, what do you think that plasma is? What's it all about?
Superheated gas, our atmosphere reacting to the high temperatures surrounding these craft. I say that having talked to a lot of contactees. Dolly Safran is one I'll reference. I often bring her up because she...
Yeah, well, we had a wonderful time with Dolly on this show. I remember very vividly. And folks, if you're a subscriber, just input Dolly, DollySafron, into the search engine, and you can watch that show, or you can watch it on YouTube if you have the link. So, that was very extraordinary. And I personally have been close to these things a number of times, and I'm not remembering heat, but then again, I haven't been close to them when it was running. You know who remembered a great deal of heat was Betty Andreasen. Remember and I wonder if that's a kind of mixed up screen memory of being close to a UFO when she's talking about the heat, and she sees this phoenix come up, and maybe that's all kind of a rearranged, I wouldn't say screen, but rearranged memory.
It does come up in a number of cases. I remember the Westall High School case in Melbourne, Australia, 1966. The students ran right up to this craft, which they said was blazing with heat. And I know of other cases like that. Dolly Safran, you know, having had a lot of experiences, she says this is one of the reasons they actually go into the water, is to cool down.
Maybe so.
And I saw, you know, after she said that, I started looking up cases where these objects would go into the water and steam would rise up. And clearly that's what they were doing, cooling off their craft.
Steam does rise up. I know people who've seen that.
Yeah, I suspect that's what's going on here.
Yeah, exactly. Free Dreamland, we're going to take another break. We'll be right back. We're talking to Preston Dennett. His new book, Not From Here, the latest volume, you can get it through the unknowncountry.com store. Just go to unknowncountry.com, click on the store tab, click on podcast authors, and you'll be right there with all of our fascinating podcast authors. Talk about an incredible library. I've got one. Part of it's right back there, and it's because of this show. And Preston's books are certainly in it, and they should be in yours as well. PrestonDennett.weebly.com. That's the... See, here I am pushing 80, and I really have a good memory. I can remember all my guests' website addresses and everything. So anyway, we'll be right back. We're back. We're talking to Preston Dennett from my brand new, beautiful studio created by Crystal Kelly, who's been on Dreamland recently, and her team are also now my social media team. That's why you're seeing all kinds of new reels and stuff on Instagram, and it is getting to be loads and loads of fun. And so keep up with me on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. I'm not on Twitter as much, but Instagram and Facebook and TikTok, yes, I'm there. So if that's where you are, look for Whitley Strieber. I'll be there. Preston, let's go on now. You go down. Another fascinating part of the phenomenon that you cover is the ability to call down UFOs. Now, I know John Martin in Georgia who does that very effectively. And there are others who do it as well. So let's talk a little bit about that, will you?
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting facet, which of course has gotten a lot of real attention lately over the past few decades, close encounters of the fifth kind, human initiated encounters. And this has great potential because it allows you to study not UFO reports passively, but actually do live field work and study the phenomena in live present time. And of course has the potential to really go much farther than that. Anyone can see a UFO, skeptics, believers alike. This offers that opportunity and also to develop a relationship and perhaps even have onboard experiences and more. So I think the potential is incredible, really limitless. And it's been going on for quite a long time. A lot of people have been doing this. I became interested in this when I interviewed this gentleman by the name of Arnie Weiler, who was working for NBC and decided to do this publicity stunt for them in Santa Monica. This is at the La Brea Tar Pits, the George Page Museum. He was working with a special effects guy, Rick Liebert, and they had set up these pixel lights, computerized lights, in the shape of a peacock's tail, the NBC logo. And it looks kind of like almost a full disc, sort of mimicking the appearance of a UFO, which might be significant here because when they turn this on, this whole setup, all these colored lights, they turned it on and it was starting to lift up. Three UFOs came swooping down very quickly as if to examine it, which was amazing. And Arnie shouted out to Rick Liebert, "Hey, look, UFOs." And Rick kind of brushed it off as if it was a casual thing and said, "Oh, this happens all the time when I do this kind of work." So I did this interview with Arnie Weiler. I'm like, "You need to put me in touch with Rick Liebert." And he confirmed it and gave me another case.
Wow. That's amazing, Preston. I have to tell you, it's very, very extraordinary. It's as if they're, could they have mistaken it like a decoy duck? I mean, are there any other cases where people intentionally try to decoy them? Of course, there are many, but I don't think I know one that worked in Kathleen Martin's book, Taken. There's a story of a guy who owned a small airport at Bush airport in the desert somewhere. And a UFO landed at the end of his runway. And he started putting out all kinds of light glow lights and things. And it came back. And the end of the story was the guy finally went crazy because they came into his hangar and into his bedroom in the little operation he had. And he shot one of them and it haunted him. And the next thing you know, he's crazy and dies. Wow. So it's quite a story. But tell us more, if you will, about this whole subject, because like every UFO subject, if I ask you to go into detail, you can talk for 2 hours.
Yeah, I mean, I found this to be quite interesting because I thought the same thing. I'm like, well, did they not know that this was a UFO or what's going on here? Because I did find a case in Arizona where some people had purposefully set up a fake UFO and it brought down a craft as if to examine it. I found other cases of a light festival in Nevada that was taking place. UFO came down for that. And speaking with Rick Liebert, who was involved in the Santa Monica case, he said back in 1978, because I asked him, tell me another case. You say this happens often. He says, well, one case I can tell you vividly because I remember it really well. 1978, the tallest building then in San Diego, a bank building. He was working with a local radio station doing publicity. They'd set up an argon laser to play and beat to this rock station. And no sooner had they set it up, they'd gotten FAA approval and all the things you need to do. 10 of them were up there on the top of this building and turned on this green argon laser, and it started to play and beat to the music. No sooner had they done this when two craft showed up, V-shaped, with little lights along each end. One was quite low. He said it was probably 50 feet overhead. He says it was hard to tell how big it was or how close it was, but very low. Another one was several hundred feet up, and it just moved slowly over. They could hear it thrumming, and off it went. And it was just fascinating because this was a publicity stunt like the other one. And yeah, it generated some attention, not the kind they were expecting. But wow, this is when I joined CSETI, which was spearheaded, of course, by Stephen Greer. And he had come to LA to form a CSETI group. And I became part of that group. And over the next 5 years or so, we did meditation and used lights to call down UFOs successfully on at least a half dozen occasions. I mean, one was stupendous. We were communicating back and forth with this object with our flashlights.
This is Stephen Greer's protocol?
Yeah. Yeah. I spoke to him about it. And it's funny. I wrote those two cases in UFO Universe magazine. He's like, you know, I read that. And that's what really inspired me to get CSETI going. That thought was a really nice thing to say. And I thought, wow, that's very cool.
Yeah, well, his protocols work. He's apparently, you're not the first person who's told me that they've had extraordinary experiences using his protocols or in his groups. So, you know, he's a very controversial guy. I hear all kinds of things about him, but I'm never paying any attention to any of that. That's not how I operate. But he does have a bottom line, and that is a lot of people are successful who call in UFOs in ways that he suggests. Gosh, I remember going all the way back into the 80s, I guess, Bootsy Galbraith, who was John Kenneth Galbraith's wife, was a friend of Anne. She had a lot of Hotsy friends, social friends in New York. And she had gone to Mexico with Stephen Greer and seen UFOs on that trip, and she was very impressed with this.
Uh-huh. Yeah, there's a lot of cases. I found three separate cases of people who use massive searchlights. And there was a very famous case in Ohio, Norwood, Ohio, from 1949 to 1950, where UFOs showed up on, I think, 10 separate occasions every time they turned on this massive searchlight. And they caught it on film, photographs. There's a very famous photograph where you can see this UFO in the searchlight beam, and it's bending the beam of light right up to it, which is something you can't really fake. This generated interest at very high levels of government, who really refused to comment on it. I don't think it even made it into Project Blue Book, but it's a very well-documented case with a lot of trained observers who should know if something this is an unusual craft or not.
Yeah, you'd think. But, you know, they're so, when it comes to the government is so obsessively secretive. They're so secretive that they've almost proved that the UFOs actually exist but, you know, if they didn't exist, it would be a lot easier to hide and there would be less hidden. But it is there's a vast amount hidden. There are enormous amounts. And that, to me, proves that it is real more than anything.
Yeah, I'm astonished by how many cases there are. The more I dig into this, there's just an endless number of people who've had encounters like this. I don't think the general public has any real idea how many people have seen UFOs.
Okay, here's another part of the book that is so great that I loved, because it's, you know, people say to me, don't always tell your story on your shows, but my story is part of this. So what I'm going to say here is, before I ask Preston, without telling you what it is, I'm going to say, this happened to me. And now, Preston, what I want to do you to do is to tell about appearances of ETs at UFO conferences. And if you have any information about hybrids, I don't absolutely remember in the book, add that in too. But that's the next question.
Yeah, this was something that kind of caught my attention when I think it was Reverend John Polk put out a book called Blue Beings at UFO Conference. And I thought, well, isn't that interesting? Because 1994, the Triad Conference, March of 1994, down in Coronado Island, San Diego, I attended that conference. There was a lot of really interesting speakers there, like Colin Andrews and Yvonne Smith and Bud Hopkins and others. And now it's a very well-known incident, which Yvonne Smith has written a book about. I co-wrote a book with one of the witnesses, because the evening before the conference, many people had a visitation. They were staying at the Village Inn right next to the Coronado. This is not at the conference proper, the night before it. But it got me intrigued, because it wasn't long after that I was speaking at another conference in Irvine. This was, let me see, I guess it was sometime after 2015. But I was speaking about USOs, unidentified submersible objects, and found out that UFOs were seen. Well, someone was taken from their hotel room by Grays. Jonathan Michael Knox, I think is his name. And he was healed of a torn Achilles tendon. He had a roommate who saw the Grays. She was taken on board. She said she saw speakers who were at the conference on board the craft. And it's not just one or two testimonies. There was another of a group of people. This was reported to New Fork, National UFO Reporting Center, who saw UFOs hovering over the hotel on that same evening. And that's when I started connecting the dots. I'm like, are there other cases like this? And yeah, there were quite a few, about a dozen. And some, were first-hand reports of apparent ETs walking among the population. Others are UFOs hovering over the conference. And there was a really amazing incident, contact in the desert.
Oh, yeah.
2016 in Joshua Tree.
Well, I was there.
Numerous people saw objects flying around and caught on film, viewed through binoculars, night vision goggles. Many hundreds of witnesses. Several made reports to MUFON and New Fork.
Yeah, because the UFOs were visible. I mean, they weren't satellites either. They were, in other words, I saw some of them myself. Another one that used to have UFOs over the conferences is the Gulf Breeze UFO conference. I went there for many years, and they had UFOs show up every year virtually. I mean, not only Buddy, the red UFO that would fly along the horizon on at the sea, but also right over, like we were eating breakfast once in a diner near the conference, and people came rushing in and said, there's a UFO over the diner. And now we know why, because it was all a bunch of UFO investigators sitting together at breakfast, and there was a UFO over the diner. So it happens.
It's strangely appropriate, isn't it? I mean, kind of you would expect it with so many people who are not only interested in studying the subject, but who have had experiences themselves.
So that I used to say it's a process of acclimatization. There's a theater in the sky because they're taming us. They're getting us used to them.
I think they're doing a publicity campaign. You know,
I think so.
Hundreds of UFOs in the sky. There was one in Farmington, New Mexico, around 1953, I think it was. No, 1950. That involved hundreds of objects. Most of the town saw it. This is 3,000 people. It stopped traffic in the street. Schools came out, people came out of their businesses. The mayor saw it, police, the newspaper office. This was a clear display. I think that's going the same thing going on in these conference encounters.
Yeah. Now, I think that, yeah, because let's sort of circle back to aliens at conferences, because I've seen a couple of things at Contact in the Desert that were not, I don't think, were human beings. They looked human, sort of, but, and I was close enough to one of them to get a good look. And it was not a costume. It was just a person with very little body hair and very pale. And I thought I heard someone say in this sort of soft voice, you know, mild, very mild voice, "Hello, Whitley." And I'm not sure, though, if it was someone who said that physically or it came from this person who was sitting beside me, because I didn't see anyone around me and there was no one behind me and no one followed up. I mean, you'd think if that you someone says hello, Whitley, then you look at a smiling face and you say hello back. So I thought it might have been a telepathic message.
Wouldn't surprise me. I've heard of cases like that. ETs are seen in public places all the time, places you would never expect. And I've talked to many people who've had that kind of experience. One guy was at a street fair. He was a street vendor in San Francisco selling jewelry and had someone come up to his table and was talking to him telepathically, but it took him a bit to catch on to this. And he asked her to try on the rings and she wouldn't do it. And finally, she walked away, but turned around and said, "This is why I can't wear your jewelry," and pulled out her hands, which were not normal by any means. Very long, slender, kind of bony, almost clawish hands. And then he got a quick flash of, you know, not a quite fully human appearance, but very dark eyes and bald head, which he did not see that when she was walking up to the table. So there's some ability, you know, that,
enough to, the grays can do that. They can, like, in my book, Them, there's a story of a guy whom I know now, and he's a very real human being. There's nothing unusual about him, except when he was in the Army, he had a girlfriend and fell in love with her. And they finally, after a long time of him, of course, wanting nothing else, and she being a girl and being careful, they went to bed together, after which she called him over to her flat, her apartment, and sat him down and said, "I'm going to show you something, and then you're never going to see me again after tonight." And he was, of course, shocked. Oh, no, because he's in love with this woman. She sits across from him and slowly turns into a gray and then back into a human being. And he was so shocked when she said for him to leave, that, you know, goodbye, he just left. And she was gone after that. He never saw her again. And I said to him, "What do you think? What do you think she did that for?" And he said, "Well, I don't know." And I said, "Well, I do know. You've got a child somewhere. She's had a baby with you. That's what it was all about from beginning to end."
Got a few cases like that. One guy interviewed personally.
Tell us some stories. I'm fascinated, of course.
Yeah, one gentleman I interviewed for my book, Humanoids in High Strangeness, had a very weird day where he first saw two tall guys dressed up in suits who he thought were CIA guys, but clearly weren't. Later that day, he saw them again. They were dressed in robes, and he had a telepathic conversation. But I'm shortening this because it's a fairly long story, and I want to get to the interesting part where he was going home. He's a young man, 19, 20 years old. This is in Oregon. And this lady, who's wearing the same robes, walks up to him, and he's like, she's strangely perfect. Her hair is very manicured. And she's attractive, and basically offered an intimate relationship in very straightforward language. And he's a young man, you know, always looking for a good time. Sure. And takes her home. And she was very awkward in her, the way she interacted. And gosh, it's hard to talk about this without getting into really graphic terms, because it was a very graphic relationship he had with her. And she was basically instructing him, don't do this, don't do that. You know, we'll get an infection. And he said she was not normal anatomically. Let me put it that way. Her skin seemed almost rubbery. And at one point he had a vision of her absolutely bald and with large dark eyes. And she quickly ended the intimacy and walked out. And that's when he did. He got a good view of her, and she didn't have hair like he thought. And I forget what it was. She said something along the lines of, yeah, this was something she wanted to experience. And I know of other cases. I mean, real quick, another lady went to a gas station, saw this beautiful, handsome man, and he seduced her. She does not take guys home, she said, but went home with him. This was in Florida. Ended up having intimate relations, looks in the mirror and sees his reflection. And it's not this handsome man with blonde hair and blue eyes. It's a gray. He immediately walked into the bathroom. This bathroom has no windows, so there's no escape. And he didn't come out. She opens the door and he's gone. Boom.
And they can go right through a wall.
Yeah.
You know, you wonder who they are, because if they want to cohabit with us and make love with us, then they must be able to have babies with us. And would that not explain the female in the first story you told being sort of on the edge of human? There were things about her that were almost human. That's correct. And maybe she was literally a hybrid who was more like three quarters gray and one quarter human. And it means that we can interbreed, which means that we're somehow or another from the same, we have something, we have very similar genes. Very similar. And yet the way they look and what they can do is not close.
Yeah, I think they are clearly, well, not only technologically advanced, but psychically advanced. But I do think that they're probably human, almost, because when people do encounter ETs, humanoids, they're bipedal almost always. There are a few exceptions and outliers, but the fact that there are ones that look pretty much just like us, and then we have grays and, you know, praying mantids and short humanoids and little blue beings and tall whites and so forth. But if you look at the variation of ancestry on Earth alone, I'm wondering if you could stick in an ET here or there and probably fit right in. So many contactees have been told the same message. We are you, you are us, we are one, we share a common heritage. You know, one day we used to look like you, or one day you will look like us, this sort of thing. So yeah, I think this speaks really strongly to our relationship to them, which is probably much closer, I think, than perhaps we recognize.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, and Secretary Laurie Barnes was told that in the 50s when she had one of her only UFO confrontations. She had a very few, but they were very, very spectacular. And that was with these dark blue dwarf-like figures that often show up with the grays. And one of them said, when she said, he said, why are you afraid? Why do you fear us? And she said, because you're so ugly. And he said, one day, my dear, you will look just like us. What can it mean? Preston, you got any ideas? Because she's not the only one who reports that, as you said.
I think it's a clear message that we are them. They are us, that we share a common heritage. It's such a common message. You know, ET is
repeating themselves to somebody. I mean, given the way they look and the way we look, someone's deformed. Who is it? Which ones?
Well, you know, the grays, people who have been taken on board the grays and they collect genetic material have been told, you know, we have suffered some genetic damage, which has caused problems with reproduction. So I think that there's something going on there that perhaps they're trying to repair or reinvigorate their DNA. Hard to say for sure. This is still a relatively new field in terms of being taken seriously and studied.
Well, I think hopefully there'll be enough information to study it soon. Free side, we have come to the end of our time together. I would like to thank you all, as always, for being with us. Subscribers, stay with us because we're getting into the areas of human levitation and out-of-body experiences. Preston knows a lot about these, and he can go out of his body. So we're going to learn about all of that. And I want to know his suggestions as to how we can do this, because I've had it happen a few times, and it is fun. Free Dreamlanders, remember Preston's book is Not From Here. It's available on bookstores and Amazon, I'm sure. And his website is prestondennett.weebly.com. Okay, Preston, let's go on. There's one thing that from the Not From Here series that I still want to ask, and that's about names. All the years I have had this in my life, as I have not been given a single name, but have been led to believe that if you know their name, you've kind of captured them in a way which I don't really believe, but I don't believe a lot of things they say. But tell us about names. I'm fascinated.
Yeah, I was doing research for this, and I saw some of the stuff you put out there regarding this with Betty Andreasen and translating some of the stuff she said into Gaelic.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Well, just let me interject here. What happened was that there was some, what she thought and Ray Fowler thought was star language. Ray Fowler was the researcher who did this. And it looked, when I heard it and looked at the words, the cadence of it suggested to me that it was Gaelic. And I found a Gaelic expert who said it was not modern Gaelic, but it was a form of very old Gaelic. And it translated to children of the northern peoples, you wander in eternal darkness. It's one of the most haunting messages in the whole UFO experience, in my opinion.
Yeah, I was fascinated by this. And I started looking into it because I remember reading somewhere somebody doing a study on ET names, and I couldn't find it. I scoured every book I had and started, running across examples of this. And it does turn up quite a bit. A number of contactees have been given names. It's certainly come up in my own research. A lady, a waitress by the name of Marianne, had an encounter with a gray who introduced himself as, of all things, Kevin. And she suspects that wasn't his real name and that he used it to basically reduce the fear factor, which certainly is interesting because I've run across that before. But in Dolly Safran's case, they gave her names as well. The craft itself gave her a big, long name. The craft are embodied by a living being. And she finally just shortened it to Talata. But other beings gave their names, such as Swerda, I think, was one of the names of the grays.
Misha
was another of a human-looking ET. But yeah, there's quite a few examples of people who have been given names, like Betty Andreasen, who the ET told her its name was Quazga. And that was fascinating to me because there was another contactee who was not well-known, Barbara Shute, who was given the same name, drew the ET in almost identical detail, and was one letter off of Quazga. I thought, wow.
would she have known about Betty's case?
I couldn't confirm or deny it. I think probably not, because this was early on. This was, I think, towards the 70s.
Uh-huh.
It's possible.
So it was before Betty's case was being published, if it was the 70s.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
The lady was given the name Quetzal. And that was fascinating to me because that's close to, Quetzalcoatl, a shortening of that.
Yes. So
looking at all the, you know, translations of what this would be. And, you know, names here on Earth, of course, have their various translations. And you see that as well. In, Q names.
In the communion letters, which are now at Rice University, the letters are, many of them have, make reference to a long-standing relationship in the and distant, even into the distant past. And you, the close encounter witness who's writing, is this close encounter witness is told, you're part of our family. And then the next thing you know, the family turns out to be thousands of years old. And it always makes me wonder if we're not maybe a lost colony or something.
Yeah, I think it definitely raises questions about human origins.
I'm pretty much
convinced at this point we didn't originate here in the manner, you know, Darwin outlined. I was questioning that as a young student in junior high, because evolution as it's mapped out just doesn't quite work to have, you know, all of the variation of life on Earth come from a little lemur. I mean,
yeah, lots of questions. There's something else happened as well.
But yeah, the names were really interesting. One lady I talked to, she was given the name Kwai. Another lady, oh gosh, I loved interviewing her. She was so fascinating. Had a long conversation with the gray who introduced his name as Sen. She's like, it might be Zen, but I think I'm going to go with Sen. Which, I don't, it's just fascinating to me how many cases there are of this. Bill Hamilton, pretty well-known researcher, saw gray. He says, my name is Quasar. Thought that was kind of interesting as well. Close to Quasar. We love names here on Earth, especially. We like to name everything. It brings order and understanding to a certain extent. So it's a fascinating subject that I think deserves more attention, because it really hasn't gotten much study.
No, it certainly hasn't. And there should be more study, you know. By the way, let's move on to flight in its various forms, levitation, and out of body experiences. Back in 2007, you published a book called Human Levitation, which I have found fascinating, and it is the most exhaustive list of levitators I've ever seen assembled. I can only think of one that might not be on that list. It's a fantastic list. I'm looking at it here. It's 333 levitators up to 2005. You don't have in it Padre Pio, the Italian saint who converted General Twining to Catholicism. And I've always wondered if you converted him because General Twining saw him levitate or not. But these, let's go into this a little bit. What do you think causes this? I'd love to levitate. I bet every single person listening or watching here would like to do the same.
I think it's a natural human ability. I really do. Because looking into it, you know, I initially became interested because a family friend, Mary Frank, said she levitated as a child. I'm like, no, you didn't. She's like, no, honestly, I did. She was 7 years old, on her way to the doctor's office, went running down a corridor, turned. She was out of view of her family. And this is when she says something picked her up. And she flew all the way down the corridor, turned a corner, flew all the way down and landed on her feet. Tried many times to duplicate it, couldn't. No one believed her, but she swears up and down to this day she flew. And I remember in college reading about a couple of very famous levitators, St. Joseph of Cupertino and St. Teresa of Avila. He was in Italy, she was in Spain. Very well-documented cases. And I found a couple of other people I knew. I started asking around. People thought I was crazy, but I found a couple of other people who had this experience. And that's what got me involved in this. And it became immediately apparent to me that this is connected to astral projection. Because a lot of these people who had this experience, it began with them with having out-of-body experiences.
Have you ever levitated since you've had out-of-body experiences?
I haven't. I think, you know, if I were to take the time and really dedicate, you know, and meditate all the time, I would love to be able to do this. I've talked to people who have. Dolly Saffron has experienced it. And I've talked to a number of contactees who have had this experience as well. It's connected to that as well, because the whole contactee experience has a tendency to ignite your psychic abilities. So I think there's a connection there as well. But this is present in pretty much every culture on our planet. The case is going back millennia. Some are very well documented. And this has been proven conclusively in a laboratory setting repeatedly. So I'm surprised it's not more popular among mainstream science, because this has been proven.
The reason it isn't is that we've got a problem in science, in that we have slipped into the assumption that the only scientific method has to do with the material world, and that no methodology, no matter how repeatable the experiments, no matter how consistent they are, is valid unless there is some kind of physical effect involved. In other words, there's got to be materials involved, or energy or radiation of some kind of material. And if we can't detect the energy, and that's the problem here, then as far as the scientific method that we understand it, as we understand it now, is concerned, we can't prove anything. And that's why, like the work of J.B. Ryan and all of that work, proving things like telepathy and the material, proving childhood memories of previous lives, all of this stuff is ignored by the mainstream because there's nothing physical to hang your hat on.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, because this is a natural human ability. It's one of what the Eastern religions call siddhis, which are sort of supernatural, superhuman abilities that manifest on the pathway towards spiritual enlightenment. Some are superhuman strength, immunity to fire, invisibility. Sounds like science fiction, but there are many cases of those as well. And certainly levitation is probably one of the more common and, I would say, dramatic of these abilities. And it's amazing how many well-documented cases there are. These countries have really got a greater understanding, I think, than perhaps we do here in the U.S. They've got approaches and meditations that you can do to basically get this ability.
There was a guest on Dreamland. I don't think it was Robert Hieronymus. It might have been, who was a novice in a seminary. And he tells the story that he was assigned to be the assistant of the archdiocese or the diocesan exorcist. And so he went with this exorcist to a home for the mentally ill, and where there was a woman who had become very violent and impossible to keep in her home quite suddenly. And she was in this institution, and of course her family were frantic to get her out of the institution and get her back to normal, because this had all happened rather suddenly, as I recall the story. And during the exorcism, this was the situation. She was sitting in a room in a wheelchair. There were two orderlies, because she had these bouts of violent behavior, a psychiatrist, the exorcist, and my friend. And all of a sudden, in the middle of the exorcism, the woman comes floating up out of the wheelchair. about to, like, as he's described it, to chest height.
Wow.
And he turns to the exorcist. The exorcist calmly says, just push her back down. And he pushes her back down into the chair. And I said to him, how did it feel? He said, she was like the weight of a balloon. And I said, did she come back up? He said, no, she stayed in the chair. But that reduction of weight is fascinatingly strange. How could that even happen? But it does.
Yeah, there was a lady, Thomas Weed, he was a researcher who went to a little country fair. And there was a lady who claimed to be able to reduce her weight by half. And she proved it to him. And he asked her, how do you do that? She says, I just feel light here in the center of my body, in her torso. She says, I don't know how I do it, but it was an ability my father had as well. And there's a number of cases where it does appear to be genetic. In the royal family of Hungary, they had numerous cases of them levitating. I found several other where it's apparently carried through down family lines. The case you cited, I call that mediumistic levitation. I broke it down into 7 categories because there are a lot of cases of people levitating in some way involved with spirits or ghosts or hauntings, possession, this sort of thing. But there are different types. Lots of nuns and monks levitate. I call that ecstatic levitation, which happens spontaneously after years of prayer. And there's meditative levitation where people actually pursue this and are able to, you know, they're trying to do it and they achieve this ability. There's crisis levitation. Robert Monroe experienced this. He tripped down some icy steps and floated down. I've got several cases of that where people perhaps in a fever or a fall, this type of situation, float down to the ground. There's spontaneous levitation, kind of a catch-all category. There's a whole category of just kids who levitate between ages about 4 to 12, floating up and down stairs. I've got so many cases of that. Sleeping levitation. This is connected to dissociation, out-of-body experiences.
Yeah.
After a case of people levitating in their sleep, and their partner wakes up and sees them floating above the bed. And one final category is traveling levitation or running levitation. Again, present in many cultures. Here in the U.S., it was called Indian running. Here's an example real quick of this guy who claimed this ability. And all the people, they had to go to a town that was several hundred miles away. And he says, well, I'm just going to go there on my own. And off he went running. So they decided to follow him. And they followed his footsteps, which became farther and farther apart, and then disappeared completely. And they rushed to the town. I think this was Arizona area. And got there and confirmed that he had been there for 2 days. He's like, what took you so long? This is running levitation. It's called Longgongpa in Tibetan Buddhism. This is an ability that they trained to do. There are many examples of this. It's a really interesting to me that all the different cultures have their different understanding and approach to levitation. But many cases of normal people doing it, businessmen, housewives, little children, people usually have a spiritual inclination. But many cases.
You know, I wanted to do it. The only thing I remember clearly is going up into the UFO when I was abducted, and I just shot up into the air with no elevator around me. And there was a real sense of kind of going up. It was quite dramatic, and that would have classified as levitation, but it felt like I was being pulled by something. And I want to talk a little bit about the ecstatic levitators, like Joseph of Cupertino, who I've read a lot about. And folks, you got to understand that these people didn't just do this sort of in secret with a few witnesses. He did it in an audience before the Pope with hundreds of people in the room. He did it in church. In fact, he would levitate in church and the convection currents with the candles burning in the front of the church would slowly cause him to float toward the candles. And it made the bishop so nervous that he would catch on fire that he made him stay outside during Mass. And after mass, they'd find him up in the tops of trees and things. Well, what in the world is ecstatic levitation, Preston?
Yeah, I mean, these are all just different ways of explaining, I think, the same thing. There's some evidence that this can be externally produced by spirits, but most of the cases, it seems to be a natural human ability that is ignited through prayer, perhaps, or meditation, or specific breathing exercises. St. Joseph of Cupertino is probably one of the top 10 best verified cases. He was known as the Flying Friar of Europe, and there's some 200 documented accounts. He had immunity to fire, by the way, and superhuman strength. He exhibited both of those on several occasions. They locked him up for, I think it was 10 years, trying to stop the crowds of people that were following him around Europe. I think what's happening with these, you know, particularly the Catholic and Christian saints and stuff, is that they are meditating so much, they reach this point of where this ability manifests naturally, and they reach this kind of state of nirvana or ecstasy, where this ability just manifests naturally. Saint Gerard of Majella, another one of my favorite cases, a number of them can control this really well. And they asked him, how do you do this? He says, I just get into this certain state where anything is possible. One lady, she was a well-known nun, I think, I forget her name. At any rate, she was able to levitate at will. She did it pretty much secretly, but was caught several times, you know, rising up to dust off the church in various areas. She would float up the stairs. There was an emergency once where she had to go attend to a sick person. It was very muddy out, and she floated right above the mud, didn't get her habit at all dirty, while everyone else is slogging behind her trying to catch up. And she's an old woman. I mean, she was aged. So this is an ability that these people suddenly manifest naturally through hours and hours and hours of prayer and meditation. And it just comes spontaneously. It's not something that St. Teresa of Avila didn't like it. And whenever it happened, she would try to pull herself down, couldn't do it. She was really embarrassed by it. And it manifested after many, many out-of-body experiences.
It's interesting that, did she think it was origin was not of God, or... Because I know that in the Middle Ages, the Inquisition was constantly trying to figure out whether or not a given levitator was of Satan or of God, right. And if they decided you were of Satan, you were levitated right up into the form of pot and column of smoke. So
yeah, it's really important, because if you were in the church, you were probably okay. But if you started levitating and you weren't a saint or a monk, you ran a very
dangerous situation.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Usually attributed to, you know, other forces that were not evil. But no, she absolutely connected it to God.
Oh, yeah. Well, so, and she just didn't like it. She felt like God was oppressing her. So she was sort of a female Job.
Yeah. You know, what's also really interesting about these cases is a number of them will emit visible light. Thomas Raeliano, he was meditating in his chambers, and everyone came running in because they thought there was a fire. They opened the door. He's floating in the middle of the room, blazing with this bright white light. They tried to pull him down. They could not do it. He was locked in this air there. But it was so bright, they could barely look at him. And there's probably a 20 or 30 cases I found where people radiate light out of their bodies. I found some modern cases, too. Just recently, a lady on Facebook's like, look at this picture of me. Does it look like I'm glowing? Like, I actually contacted her. I'm like, yes, you know, you should know there are cases of this.
Yeah, and they're ordinary people. In other words, they're not as, is this related to God, or is there something else going on? In other words, a lot of people who are not religious ecstatics end up in this situation where they might levitate.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's the case of Daniel Douglas Hume.
The Hume case, exactly. Tell us a little bit about that.
He became a medium at a very young age when all this kind of poltergeist-like activity broke out around him, started communicating with spirits very early on into his, quote, seances. Someone turned to him and says, "Are you aware that you're floating above your chair?" And he immediately came down. But this was the first of what would be hundreds of levitations in front of many, many people. He traveled the world. He subjected himself to scientific scrutiny, often could only levitate in low light situations, but did it enough times to prove it to numerous scientists. And he said it was his spirit friends doing it. So I think in some cases, that's a good case that shows there's outside influences here. But most, it appears to be a natural human ability. There was a farmer in the Soviet Union who was regularly levitating in front of people. He says, "I don't know how I do it. It's willpower. I just think and I rise right up." Another very famous case, Yogina Rus. He's still alive. He's teaching in Japan. He allowed himself to be photographed on 7 occasions. He's like, "That's it. I'm not a trained monkey. I've proven it." And that's not what it's about. It's not about this ability. It's about, you know, gaining awareness and enlightenment. But he said, basically, it's a very easy process where you simply go out of your body, fix your point of consciousness, fix your consciousness on a point above you, and the physical body will follow up. He says, "This is how I do it." And you can see these photographs if you are, you know, able to dig online. Yogi Narus, Naruse. And there's it's astounding because these are really good photographic evidence of this, in one of many cases where it's been proven in front of scientific people.
Can you repeat the spelling?
Yeah, Naruse.
Okay, folks, so it's Yogi Narus. If we can find any of the images, they'll be in the show and you'll be seeing them right now. And if not, you better dig harder than we did. Okay, let me get myself back into the picture here. Now, you've had many out-of-body experiences. I've had a few, and I started with Robert and Rose Journeys Out of the Body. And I came out very cleanly one night and moved around my bedroom and out into the front yard. And as I moved through the wall and window, I could see a African mask hanging in the window, but it was a face of a gray. And I should have known what was going on because I could look back at my own body. It was so perfect. It was an absolutely clean and clear OBE. And I thought afterwards, I had a lot of trouble getting back in because the interior of my body was slick like mercury, and my soul kept falling out of it until I suddenly saw my father mowing the lawn and he says, "When are you going to come help me?" And that did it. I was back in my body immediately. But I never was able to do it again like that. I thought at the time, "Oh, wow, now I can do this every night." I couldn't ever get there again on my own. And I just wonder if that mask in the window wasn't that the grays were actually controlling the whole thing. And I want to ask you, can you get out of your body. Can you tell us a little bit about, and me, how you do it and repeat? You've talked about it a little bit before, but and what happens and where you go.
Yeah. By the way, I have put together a little 2-3 page guide. If anyone wants it, I'll send it to you. Just, you know, send me an email. And I'll send it off. My email is prestonufo@gmail.com. And I explain exactly how to do it. The only real obstacle preventing people from doing this is a couple of things. Fear can be very scary. Skepticism, people don't think they can do it. Laziness, they're not putting forth the effort. Ignorance, they don't know how to do it. Those are really the only obstacles. Anybody can do this. In fact, you're already doing this. This is something that happens to us each and every night. We all go out of body, so the trick is really remembering it. The benefits are unestimable. I mean, I've got cases, 30 cases of people healed of physical illness. It ignites your psychic abilities. There's every reason in the world to do this. And it's not hard. It involves just a few basic steps. The first would be physical relaxation. And this is difficult for people. And I think this is where a lot of people kind of falter a little bit. Because when we go to bed, often we're still tossing and turning. We've got our fists clenched. We're grinding our teeth. And it's difficult to reach that level of relaxation, which I would kind of compare it to when you stay in a hot tub for an hour and you come out and you're just flat out relaxed. You want to relax to the point where you start to feel a number of sensations such as heaviness or lightness, numbness perhaps, movement. Ultimately, you want to reach what's called the vibratory state, which will feel like anything from a mild to very severe electric shock or intense vibration. Robert Monroe described it as a mild electric shock. What happened to me, I thought I was being electrocuted the first time. It was terrifying. But that's how relaxed you want to be, to the point where when you're lying in bed at night, you're not even quite sure where your limbs are. Fully relaxed. I would often do it early in the morning because that's how long it would take me to get relaxed. It takes 20 minutes relaxing all your muscle groups. That's the first major step. This is doing it consciously because it can happen spontaneously as well.
And how do you go about relaxing your muscle groups? What's the procedure?
Visualizations help a lot. You can imagine that there's all these little guys who are working your muscles and you have them march right out. That works. I heard about a technique of just imagine an eraser going up and down your body and erasing all the tension and erasing your body. As soon as I did it, I put two or three swipes of this imaginary eraser on my legs. This sounds crazy, but it worked. I went right out. Just go through your muscle groups and allow it just to let go. It's really just a process of letting go. So that's where a lot of people, I think, have some difficulty. If you can use music or white noise, try to get a really comfortable position. Don't fall asleep. But relaxation is absolutely key to this.
Because I'd really like to do it. I've had, as I say, I've had some absolutely premier experiences that were not generated by me. Like there was one where I was at a conference and I did my 3 a.m. meditation. I was very tired. We'd driven up a long way that day. And I went to sleep after that. And suddenly was waked up at 4 a.m. again. They used to wake me up by punching me on the shoulder in those days. And I was pissed off. I thought, shit, I just did it and I'm tired. And I got out of the bed to go sit in the chair and do another meditation. And I felt a pinch on the right at the C1 vertebra. And I could feel all these I guess the chakras were sort of opening around, down my spine. And I didn't relate that. I was intent on going to that chair. And then the next thing I knew, I was in the hallway, 4 o'clock in the morning, and my door was locked. And I thought, holy moly, how did I get out here? Because I didn't realize I'd gone out of my body, that the unlocking was the unlocking of the second body against the first, and proceeded to have an incredible OBE that even involved going halfway across the country and all kinds of things. I've written about it before, talked about it, but I just can't do it on my own, Preston. It's incredibly frustrating.
Yeah, I mean, I get it. Sometimes there's a steep learning curve. You know, I've talked to people and they did it on their first try. I'm like, wow, you know, it took me a month and a half of very intense meditation because I was in a place where I really needed some answers regarding life after death and what was going on with me. So some people, yeah, it's harder than others, but I'm absolutely convinced, because I've taught people how to do this in workshops, but if you persist and the more effort you put forth, you will succeed. But there are absolutely levels and plateaus and obstacles on your way to doing this. Because physically relaxing alone is hard enough. But then you have to mentally relax. And this is such an important step, because people, of course, we're all aware of trying to fall asleep one night and your mind's just racing and you've got a million things on your mind. All of this is stealing your consciousness. If you are procrastinating, if you're dealing with anger or greed or lust or all these issues, it's taking your attention and it makes it very hard to do this. So you want to go through a process of relaxing your mind. The stream of consciousness that we have at all times is what our dreams are. As we go to sleep, it starts to become images and sounds, and we dive right into this stream of consciousness and we have our dreams. And we rise out of it and have our out-of-body experiences, which are usually not remembered. But we're doing it. So the trick is to kind of step back from this stream of consciousness. And if you're really good at it, you can slow it down and even pretty much erase it and just be in that state of total silence. That's pretty advanced. Most people are not going to be able to do that right out the bat. So you just want to sort of step back and relax your mind until all these thoughts you're having start to display as colors or images or sounds or voices even. And just step back from it. And at this point, you want to stop thinking about your body, stop thinking about your stream of consciousness, turn your attention inward and just let go. Absolutely forget about the body, forget about what you're thinking, and instead focus on the last step, which is very simple, and that's visualizations. And anything involving movement is really effective. So if you just imagine
involving movement, what do you mean exactly?
Yeah. Imagine yourself on a swing going back and forth. That works. Imagine yourself on the bow of a boat going up and down in the waves. Suddenly you'll find yourself rising right above your body. One that works really well for me, especially in the beginning, was imagining myself running down a pathway. You know, it can be a soft run, a quick jog, or running at high speed. Just imagine yourself running. And it's very interesting because suddenly you'll feel the actual movement. Maybe even hear a couple of noises, like a popping noise or a ripping noise or a loud roar. And boom, you're out of your body. An elevator, imagine yourself standing in an elevator or an escalator. Anything really that involves movement. Imagine a rope hanging down from your bed. This is another common technique. I'm like, I'm going to try this one. And I did it, and suddenly I found myself reaching up. And it wasn't a rope. It turned out to be a hard metal pull. But I pulled up on it, and pop, I came right out. I go, okay, well, that works. Rolling out of bed. This is a very common technique.
Rolling out is what I did, but where did the pole come from?
It's your imagination. It's
your imagination, of course. Yeah.
Imagination is not what people think it is. We think of it as something very airy and non-existent. But everything, and this is becomes so clear to you when you pop out of body. Thoughts are things. It's a common phrase. People knew how powerful their thoughts were, they'd be much more careful about what they think. Because everything you think when you're out of body can manifest in full color, full living color in front of you. And this is what prevents a lot of people from becoming aware of it, because they're out there having their out-of-body adventures, and they never even assume or think of the possibility that they are out of body, because it looks entirely real. It looks more real than reality, honestly. Because it's much higher definition, I guess would be the best way of putting it. Here it's low resolution here on Earth. There the colors, oh my gosh, everything is hyper real. And the way that's
have you ever been visible to others when you were out of your body?
Yes, and it took quite a bit of effort, because I would, of course, go to my family members and I'd watch them and I'd be walking around in front of them. I'm like, here I am. Could not see me. I did. For friends, I tried over and over again with zero success. is incredibly frustrating. And finally, you know, having met Dolly Safran, she described some OBEs to me. I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to give this a try. I didn't tell her. I'm in California and she's in Florida. So I'm like, all you need to do is know a person's energy, so to speak. And you say, take me there or I'm going there. So I popped out of body, and you always want to have a plan, because if you do, then you're going to be much more successful at this. Say, I want to learn about past lives or visit a healing temple or visit a deceased loved one or visit this person. So I popped out of body. I'm like, I'm going to see Dolly. And I, boom, went there instantly. Sometimes it takes a while. Sometimes it's the snap of a finger. And I came down in this garage-like area, and I saw this man sitting on a lawn chair. And I'm like, well, this is odd. That's not Dolly. This is an old man. And I walked up to him. He was very gruff and grumpy. And I said, who are you? What's your name? He said, my name is Norm. I'm like, oh, do you know where Dolly is? And he said, look at the door. Or he pointed to the door, rather, which immediately opened. And in walks Dolly. She's on the phone. She's got her cell phone up to her head. Suddenly she whirls around and looks at me. Her hair whirls around and her eyes go wide. And she speaks to me. I'm absolutely stunned. And she says to me, I can't talk now. I'm being robbed. Now that generated strong emotion in me. And strong emotion will almost always pull you back. So I got pulled back into my body. This was when I was doing interviews for the book Symmetry. So we were speaking pretty much daily. And she called me up that morning and started talking. And I'm like, well, I must have imagined this, because she's not telling me she was robbed. She's not telling me she saw me. I'm crazy. But no, just a few minutes into the conversation, she says, oh, I saw you last night. I'm like, you did? She says, yes, you came to me out of body. You did not warn me. I'm like, I'm sorry. I didn't think it would work, but did you see me? She's like, yeah, I saw you. I was on the phone. I'm like, that's what I saw. What did you say? Because I heard you say something to me. And she said, well, I was on the phone with my friend and I told you I can't talk now. I'm on the phone with Rob. I'm like, oh, Rob. Okay. Well, I thought you said I'm being robbed. That was confirmation enough for me. And she did something really funny real quick. A week or two later, I'm in bed and my room fills with this golden light. It wakes me up. The whole room is glowing with light. And I open my eyes and there, of course, is Dolly standing next to my bed. She's grinning ear to ear. She looks real young and beautiful. When we're out of body, we regress to our optimum age.
I was better than any makeup, for sure.
Oh, yeah. I looked, you know, when I was in my 20s, I looked good. And boy, man, when I see myself out of body, I'm like, I cannot wait, because I'm so buff. I look good. All my hair comes back. It is so much fun. I mean, I just cannot express how worth it it is.
When Dolly came to you, what happened?
Yes. And she did that repeatedly. She's able to, you know, do stuff that I've not been able to do. Once she stomped the floor right in front of me, I'm like, oh my gosh.
Wow.
I've not been able to move objects. I've talked to people who have. I've tried, but I'm like a ghost. I can't move objects. I've not gotten to that ability, but
I have
so many experiences lately. It's amazing.
I found Dolly to be a very powerful person, and with a lot of this type of energy. When we had lunch together, remember that?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, and she was extremely impressive. And I thought the show we did, I'm going to have her back on. We need a rematch with Dolly soon.
You should ask about her OBEs. Oh my gosh.
I mean, yes, that's what I'm going to do. Okay. Incredibly enough, we've come to the end of our time together. As always with Preston Dennett, it starts and then it's over and you think, my goodness, how could that time have passed so quickly? If you want missing time, just go to a Preston Dennett interview. So I've had a fabulous time, Preston. I'm sure my viewers and listeners have too. And folks, if you like or don't like the new look of the site, let me know. And it was created by a wonderful
podcaster herself, Kelly Crystal Kelly. And Crystal has been on Dreamland, and she is also a wonderful social media expert. So thank you, Crystal, for this wonderful look. And thank you, Preston, for a fabulous show. I surely enjoyed every minute of it. And folks, as always, thank you. Thank you for being subscribers to Unknown Country and Dreamland. And tell your friends, that's the only way we can grow. And it's no reason to be embarrassed anymore. People are accepting all of this stuff. So thanks.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.